them on trial. The railroads were particularly important, for there were indeed many insects hidden beneath railroad uniforms, and they had to be rooted out, and some of them slapped down. And telegraphers, for some reason, were, for the most part, inveterate insects who had no sympathy for the Soviets. Nor could you say a good word about Vikzhel, the All-Russian Executive Committee of the Union of Railroad Workers, nor about the other trade unions, which were often filled with insects hostile to the working class. Just those groups we have so far enumerated represent an enormous number of people, several years' worth of purge activity. In addition, how many kinds of cursed intellectuals there were, restless students and a variety of eccentrics, truth-seekers and holy fools, of whom even Peter the Great had tried in vain to purge Russia, and who were always a hindrance to a well-ordered, strict regime. It would have been impossible to carry out this hygienic purging, especially under wartime conditions, if they had had to follow outdated legal processes and normal judicial procedures. And so an entirely new form was adopted, extrajudicial reprisal. And this thankless job was self-sacrificingly assumed by the Cheka, the sentinel of the revolution, which was the only punitive organ in human history that combined in one set of hands investigation, arrest, interrogation, prosecution, trial, and execution of the verdict. In 1918, in order to speed up the cultural victory of the revolution as well, they began to ransack the churches and throw out the relics of saints and to carry off church plate. Popular disorders broke out in defense of the plundered churches and monasteries. Here and there, the alarm bells rang out, and the true Orthodox believers rushed forth, some of them with clubs. Naturally, some had to be expended right on the spot, and others arrested. In considering now the period from 1918 to 1920, we are in difficulties. Should we classify among the prison waves all those who were done in before they even got to prison cells? And in what classification should we put those whom the committees of the poor took behind the wing of the village Soviet, or to the rear of the courtyard, and finished off right there? Did the participants in the cluster of plots uncovered in every province, two in Ryazan, one in Kostroma, Vishny Volochek, and Velizh, several in Kiev, several in Moscow, one in Saratov, Chernigov, Astrakhan, Seliger, Smolensk, Bobruisk, the Tambov Cavalry, Chembar, Velikiye Luki, Mstislavl, etc., at least succeed in setting foot on the land of the archipelago, or did they not, and are they therefore not related to the subject of our investigations? Bypassing the repression of the now famous rebellions, Yaroslavl, Murom, Rybinsk, Arzamas, we know of certain events only by their names, for instance the Kolpino executions of June 1918. What were they, who were they, and where should they be classified? There is also no little difficulty in deciding whether we should classify among the prison waves or on the balance sheets of the Civil War those tens of thousands of hostages, that is, people not personally accused of anything, those peaceful citizens not even listed by name, who were taken off and destroyed simply to terrorize or wreak vengeance on a military enemy or a rebellious population. After August the 30th, 1918, the NKVD ordered the localities to arrest immediately all right socialist revolutionaries and to take a significant number of hostages from the bourgeoisie and military officers. This was just as if, for example, after the attempt of Alexander Ulyanov's group to assassinate the Tsar, not only its members but all the students in Russia and a significant number of Zemstvo officials had been arrested. By a decree of the Defense Council of February the 15th, 1919, apparently with Lenin in the chair, the Cheka and the NKVD were ordered to take hostage peasants from those localities where the removal of snow from railroad tracks was not proceeding satisfactorily. And if the snow removal did not take place, they were to be shot. Dekreti Sovetskoy Vlasti, Decrees of the Soviet Regime, Volume 4, Moscow, 1968, page 627. At the end of 1920, by decree of the Council of People's Commissars, permission was given to take social democrats as hostages too. But even restricting ourselves to ordinary arrests, we can note that by the spring of 1918, a torrent of socialist traitors had already begun that was to continue without slackening for many years. All these parties, the SRs, the Mensheviks, the anarchists, the popular socialists, had for decades only pretended to be revolutionaries. They had worn socialism only as a mask, and for that they went to hard labour, still pretending. Only during the violent course of the revolution was the bourgeois essence of these socialist traitors discovered. What could be more natural than to begin arresting them? Soon after the outlawing of the cadets, the dispersal of the Constituent Assembly, the disarming of the Preobrazhensky and other regiments, they began in a small way to arrest, quietly at first, both SRs and Mensheviks. After June the 14th, 1918, the day members of these parties were excluded from all the Soviets, the arrests proceeded in a more intensive and more coordinated fashion. From July the 6th on, they began to deal with the left SRs in the same way, though the left SRs had been cleverer and had gone on pretending longer that they were allies of the one and only consistent party of the proletariat. From then on, it was enough for a workers' protest, a disturbance, a strike, to occur at any factory or in any little town, and there were many of them in the summer of 1918, and in March 1921 they shook Petrograd, Moscow, and then Kronstadt, and forced the inauguration of the NEP. And, coinciding with concessions, assurances, and the satisfaction for the just demands of the workers, the Cheka began silently to pick up Mensheviks and SRs at night as being the people truly to blame for these disorders. In the summer of 1918, and in April and October of 1919, they jailed anarchists right and left. In 1919, they arrested all the members of the SR Central Committee they could catch, and kept them imprisoned in the Butyrki up to the time of their trial in 1922. In that same year, Latsis, a leading Czechist, wrote of the Mensheviks, "People of this sort are more than a mere hindrance to us. That is why we remove them from our path, so they won't get under our feet. We put them away in a secluded, cozy place in the Butyrki, and we are going to keep them there until the struggle between capital and labor comes to an end." M.I. Latsis, dva goda borbi na vnutrenom fronte. Populjarny obzor dejelatske Cheke. 2 years of struggle on the home front, popular review of the activity of the Cheka. Moscow, G.I.Z., 1920, page 61. In 1919 also, the delegates to the non-party workers' congress were arrested. As a result, the congress never took place. In 1919, suspicion of our Russians returning from abroad was already having its effect. Why? What was their alleged assignment? Thus, the officers of the Russian Expeditionary Force in France were imprisoned on their homecoming. In 1919, too, what with the big halls in connection with such actual and pseudo-plots as the National Centre and the military plot, executions were carried out in Moscow, Petrograd, and other cities on the basis of lists. In other words, free people were simply arrested and executed immediately, and right and left those elements of the intelligentsia considered close to the cadets were raked into prison. What does the term close to the cadets mean? Not monarchist and not socialist. In other words, all scientific circles, all university circles, all artistic, literary, yes, and of course all engineering circles. Except for the extremist writers, except for the theologians and theoreticians of socialism, all the rest of the intelligentsia, 80% of it, was close to the cadets. In that category, for example, Lenin placed the writer Korolenko, a pitiful petty bourgeois imprisoned in bourgeois prejudices. He considered it was not amiss for such talents to spend a few weeks in prison. From Gorky's protests, we learn of individual groups that were arrested. On September the 15th, 1919, Lenin replied to him, "It is clear to us that there were some mistakes, but..." "What a misfortune! Just think about it! What injustice!" And he advised Gorky, not to waste his energy whimpering over rotten intellectuals. From January 1919 on, food requisitioning was organized and food collecting detachments were set up. They encountered resistance everywhere in the rural areas, sometimes stubborn and passive, sometimes violent. The suppression of this opposition gave rise to an abundant flood of arrests during the course of the next 2 years, not counting those who were shot on the spot. I am deliberately bypassing here the major part of the grinding done by the Cheka, the special branches, and the revolutionary tribunals as the front line advanced and cities and provinces were occupied. And that same NKVD directive of August the 30th, 1918, ordered that efforts be made to ensure the unconditional execution of all who had been involved in White Guard work. But sometimes it is not clear where to draw the line. By the summer of 1920, for example, the Civil War had not entirely ended everywhere, but it was over on the Don. Nonetheless, officers were sent from there en masse, from Rostov, and from Novocherkassk to Archangel, whence they were transported to the Solovetsky Islands, and, it is said, several of the barges were sunk in the White Sea and in the Caspian Sea. Now, should this be billed to the Civil War or to the beginning of peacetime reconstruction? In Novocherkassk, in the same year, they shot the pregnant wife of an officer because she had hidden her husband. In what classification should she be put? In May 1920 came the well-known decree of the Central Committee on subversive activity in the rear. We know from experience that every such decree is a call for a new wave of widespread arrests. It is the outward sign of such a wave. A particular difficulty, and also a particular advantage, in the organization of all these waves was the absence of a criminal code or any system of criminal law whatsoever before 1922. Only a revolutionary sense of justice, always infallible, guided those doing the purging and managing the sewage system when they were deciding whom to take and what to do with them. In this survey, we are not going to investigate the successive waves of habitual criminals, Ugolovniki, and non-political offenders, Baitoviki. Therefore, we will merely recall that the countrywide poverty and shortages during the period when the government, all institutions, and the laws themselves were being reorganized could serve only to increase greatly the number of thefts, robberies, assaults, bribes, and the resale of merchandise for excessive profit, speculation. Even though these crimes presented less danger to the existence of the Republic, they too had to be repressed, and their own waves of prisoners served to swell the waves of counter-revolutionaries. And there was speculation, too, of a purely political character, as was pointed out in the decree of the Council of People's Commissars, signed by Lenin on July the 22nd, 1918. Those guilty of selling, or buying up, or keeping for sale in the way of business, food products which have been placed under the monopoly of the Republic, a peasant keeps grains for sale in the way of business, what else is his business anyway? Imprisonment for a term of not less than 10 years, combined with the most severe forced labor and confiscation of all their property. From that summer on, the countryside, which had already been strained to the utmost limits, gave up its harvest year after year without compensation. This led to peasant revolts, and in the upshot, suppression of the revolts and new arrests. The hardest working sector of the nation was positively uprooted. Korolenko, letter to Gorky. August the 10th, 1921. It was in 1920 that we knew, or failed to know, of the trial of the Siberian Peasants' Union, and at the end of 1920 the repression of the Tambov Peasants' Rebellion began. There was no trial for them. But the main drive to uproot people from the Tambov villages took place mostly in June 1921. Throughout the province, concentration camps were set up for the families of peasants who had taken part in the revolts. Tracts of open field were enclosed with barbed wire strung on posts, and for 3 weeks every family of a suspected rebel was confined there. If within that time the man of the family did not turn up to buy his family's way out with his own head, they sent the family into exile. Even earlier, in March 1921, the rebellious Kronstadt sailors minus those who had been shot, were sent to the islands of the archipelago via the Trubetskoy bastion of the Peter and Paul fortress. That same year, 1921, began with Cheka Order No. 10, dated January the 8th, to intensify the repression of the bourgeoisie. Now, when the civil war had ended, repression was not to be reduced, but intensified. Voloshin has pictured for us in several of his poems how this worked out in the Crimea. In the summer of 1921, the State Commission for Famine Relief, including Kuskova, Prokopovich, Kishkin, and others, was arrested. They had tried to combat the unprecedented famine in Russia. The heart of the matter, however, was that theirs were the wrong hands to be offering food, and could not be allowed to feed the starving. The chairman of this commission, the dying Korolenko, who was pardoned, called the destruction of the commission the worst of dirty political tricks, a dirty political trick by the government. Korolenko's letter to Gorky, September the 14th, 1921. Korolenko also reminds us of a particularly important situation in the prisons of 1921. Everywhere they are saturated with typhus. This has been confirmed by Skripnikova and others imprisoned at the time. In that same year, the practice of arresting students began. For example, the group of Yevgenia Dyarenko in the Timirazev Academy for criticism of the system, not in public, merely in conversation among themselves. Such cases, however, were evidently few because the group in question was interrogated by Menzhinsky and Yogoda personally. Also in 1921, the arrests of members of all non-Bolshevik parties were expanded and systematized. In fact, all Russia's political parties had been buried, except the victorious one. Oh, do not dig a grave for someone else. And so that the dissolution of these parties would be irreversible, it was necessary that their members should disintegrate, and their physical bodies, too. Not one citizen of the former Russian state who had ever joined a party other than the Bolshevik party could avoid his fate. He was condemned unless, like Maisky or Vyshinsky, he succeeded in making his way across the planks of the wreck to the Bolsheviks. He might not be arrested in the first group. He might live on, depending on how dangerous he was believed to be, until 1922, 1932, or even 1937. But the lists were kept. His turn would and did come. He was arrested or else politely invited to an interrogation, where he was asked just one question. Had he been a member of such and such from then till then? There were also questions about hostile activity, but the first question decided everything, as is clear to us now, decades later. From there on, his fate might vary. Some were put immediately in one of the famous Tsarist central prisons. Fortunately, all the Tsarist central prisons had been well preserved, and some socialists even ended up in the very same cells and with the very same jailers they had had before. Others were offered the opportunity of going into exile, oh, not for long, just for 2 or 3 years. And some had it even easier. They were merely given a minus, a certain number of cities were forbidden, and told to pick out a new place of residence themselves, and for the future would they please be so kind as to stay fixed in that one place and await the pleasure of the GPU. This whole operation was stretched out over many years because it was of primary importance that it be stealthy and unnoticed. It was essential to clean out, conscientiously, socialists of every other stripe, from Moscow, Petrograd, the ports, the industrial centres, and later on the outlying provinces as well. This was a grandiose, silent game of solitaire, whose rules were totally incomprehensible to its contemporaries, and whose outlines we can appreciate only now. Someone's far-seeing mind, someone's neat hands, planned it all, without letting one wasted minute go by. They picked up a card which had spent 3 years in one pile, and softly placed it on another pile, and the person who had been imprisoned in a central prison was thereby shifted into exile, and a good way off. Someone who had served out a minus sentence was sent into exile too, but out of sight of the rest of the minus category, or else from exile to exile, and then back again into the central prison, but this time a different one. Patience, overwhelming patience, was the trait of the person playing out the solitaire. And without any noise, without any outcry, The members of all the other parties slipped gradually out of sight, lost all connection with the places and people where they and their revolutionary activities were known, and thus, imperceptibly and mercilessly, was prepared the annihilation of those who had once raged against tyranny at student meetings and had clanked their Tsarist shackles in pride. V.G. Korolenko wrote to Gorky June 29, 1921, "History will someday note that the Bolshevik Revolution used the same means to deal with true revolutionaries and socialists as did the Tsarist regime. In other words, purely police measures." In this game of the big solitaire, the majority of the old political prisoners, survivors of hard labour, were destroyed, for it was primarily the SRs and the anarchists, not the Social Democrats, who had received the harshest sentences from the Tsarist courts. They in particular had made up the population of the Tsarist hard labour political prisons. There was justice in the priorities of destruction, however. In 1920, they were all offered the chance to renounce in writing their parties and party ideologies. Some declined, and they naturally came up first for annihilation. Others signed such renunciations, and thereby added a few years to their lifetimes. But their turn, too, came implacably, and their heads rolled implacably from their shoulders. Sometimes, reading a newspaper article, one is astonished to the point of disbelief. In his Vestia of May the 24th, 1959, one could read that a year after Hitler came to power, Maximilian Hauke was arrested for belonging to none other than the Communist Party. Was he destroyed? No, they sentenced him to 2 years. After this, was he naturally sentenced to a second term? No, he was released. You can interpret that as you please. He proceeded to live quietly and build an underground organization, in connection with which the Izvestia article on his courage appeared. In the spring of 1922, the Extraordinary Commission for Struggle Against Counter-Revolution, Sabotage and Speculation, the Cheka, recently renamed the GPU, decided to intervene in church affairs. It was called on to carry out a church revolution, to remove the existing leadership and replace it with one which would have only one ear turned to heaven and the other to the Lubyanka. The so-called living church people seemed to go along with this plan, but without outside help they could not gain control of the church apparatus. For this reason, the patriarch Tikhon was arrested and 2 resounding trials were held, followed by the execution in Moscow of those who had publicized the patriarch's appeal, and, in Petrograd, of the metropolitan Benyamin, who had attempted to hinder the transfer of ecclesiastical power to the Living Church group. Here and there, in the provincial centers and even further down in the administrative districts, metropolitans and bishops were arrested, and, as always in the wake of the big fish, followed shoals of smaller fry, archpriests, monks, and deacons. These arrests were not even reported in the press. They also arrested those who refused to swear to support the Living Church Renewal Movement. Men of religion were an inevitable part of every annual catch, and their silver locks gleamed in every cell and in every prisoner transport en route to the Solovetsky Islands. From the early 20s on, arrests were also made among groups of theosophists, mystics, spiritualists. Count Palin's group used to keep official transcripts of its communications with the spirit world. Also, religious societies and philosophers of the Berdyaev circle. The so-called Eastern Catholics, followers of Vladimir Soloviev, were arrested and destroyed in passing, as was the group of A.I. Abrikosova. And, of course, ordinary Roman Catholics, Polish Catholic priests, etc., were arrested, too, as part of the normal course of events. However, the root destruction of religion in the country, which throughout the 20s and 30s was one of the most important goals of the GPU-NKVD, could be realized only by mass arrests of Orthodox believers, monks and nuns, whose black habits had been a distinctive feature of old Russian life, were intensively rounded up on every hand, placed under arrest, and sent into exile. They arrested and sentenced active laymen. The circles kept getting bigger as they raked in ordinary believers as well, old people, and particularly women, who were the most stubborn believers of all and who, for many long years to come, would be called nuns in transit prisons and in camps. True, they were supposedly being arrested and tried not for their actual faith, but for openly declaring their convictions and for bringing up their children in the same spirit. As Tanya Kodkiewicz wrote, "You can pray freely, but just so God alone can hear." She received a 10-year sentence for these verses. A person convinced that he possessed spiritual truth was required to conceal it from his own children. In the 20s, the religious education of children was classified as a political crime under Article 58.10 of the Code, in other words, counter-revolutionary propaganda. True, one was still permitted to renounce one's religion at one's trial. It didn't often happen, but it nonetheless did happen that the father would renounce his religion and remain at home to raise the children, while the mother went to the Solovetsky Islands. Throughout all those years, women manifested great firmness in their faith. All persons convicted of religious activity received tenors, the longest term then given. In those years, particularly in 1927, in purging the big cities for the pure society that was coming into being, they sent prostitutes to the Solovetsky Islands along with the nuns. Those lovers of a sinful earthly life were given 3-year sentences under a more lenient article of the code. The conditions in prisoner transports, in transit prisons, and on the Solovetsky Islands were not of a sort to hinder them from plying their merry trade among the administrators and the convoy guards. And 3 years later they would return with laden suitcases to the places they had come from. Religious prisoners, however, were prohibited from ever returning to their children and their home areas. As early as the early 20s, waves appeared that were purely national in character, at first not very large in proportion to the population of their homelands, especially by Russian yardsticks. Musavatists from Azerbaijan, Dashnaks from Armenia, Georgian Mensheviks, and Turkmenian Basmachi, who were resisting the establishment of Soviet power in Central Asia. The first Central Asian Soviets were Russian in makeup by an overwhelming majority, and were therefore seen as outposts of Russian power. In 1926, the Zionist Society of Hehalutz was exiled in toto, since it had failed to respond to the all-powerful upsurge of internationalism. Among subsequent generations, the picture has evolved of the 20s as some kind of holiday of totally unlimited freedom. In this book, we shall encounter people who viewed the 20s quite differently. The non-party students at this time sought autonomy for higher educational institutions, the right of assembly, and the removal from the curriculum of excessive political indoctrination. Arrests were the answer. These were intensified during holidays, for example, on May 1st, 1924. In 1925, about 100 Leningrad students were sentenced to 3 years in political detention for reading the Sozialistchesky Vestnik, the organ of the Mensheviks abroad, and for studying Plekhanov. In his youth, Plekhanov himself had gotten off far more lightly for speaking out against the government in front of Kazan Cathedral. In 1925, they had already begun to arrest the first young Trotskyites. Two naive Red Army men, remembering the Russian tradition, began to collect funds for the arrested Trotskyites, and they, too, were put in political detention. And, of course, it is obvious that the exploiting classes were not spared. Throughout the 20s, the hunt continued for former officers who had managed to survive. Whites, those who had not already earned execution during the Civil War. White Reds, who had fought on both sides. And Tsarist Reds, Tsarist officers who had gone over to the Red Army, but had not served in it for the whole period, or who had gaps in their army service records and no documents to account for them. They were truly put through the mill, because instead of being sentenced immediately, they too were put through the solitaire game, endless verifications, limitations on the kind of work they could do and on where they could live. They were taken into custody, released, taken into custody again. And only gradually did they proceed to the camps, from which they did not return. However, sending these officers to the archipelago did not end the problem, but only set it in motion. After all, their mothers, wives, and children were still at liberty. With the help of unerring social analysis, it was easy to see what kind of mood they were in after the heads of their households had been arrested, and thus they simply compelled their own arrest too, and one more wave was set rolling. In the 20s, there was an amnesty for Cossacks who had taken part in the Civil War. Many of them returned from the island of Lemnos to the Kuban, where they were given land. All of them were subsequently arrested. And, of course, all former state officials had gone into hiding and were likewise liable to be hunted down. They had hidden well and disguised themselves cleverly, making use of the fact that there was as yet no internal passport system, nor any unified system of workbooks in the Republic. And they managed to creep into Soviet institutions. In such cases, slips of the tongue, chance recognitions, and the denunciations of neighbors helped battle intelligence, so to speak. Sometimes sheer accident took a hand. Solely out of a love of order, a certain Mova kept at home a list of all former employees of the provincial judiciary. This was discovered by accident in 1925, and they were all arrested and shot. And so the waves rolled on, for concealment of social origin, and for former social origin. This received the widest interpretation. They arrested members of the nobility for their social origin. They arrested members of their families. Finally, unable to draw even simple distinctions, they arrested members of the individual nobility, that is, anybody who had simply graduated from a university. And once they had been arrested, there was no way back. You can't undo what has been done. The sentinel of the revolution never makes a mistake. No, there were a few ways back. The counterwaves were thin, sparse, but they did sometimes break through. The first is worthy of mention right here. Among the wives and daughters of the nobility and the officers, there were quite often women of outstanding personal qualities and attractive appearance. Some succeeded in breaking through in a small reverse wave. They were the ones who remembered that life is given to us only once, and that nothing is more precious to us than our own life. They offered their services to the Cheka GPU as informers, as colleagues, in any capacity whatsoever. And those who were liked were accepted. These were the most fertile of all informers. They helped the GPU a great deal because former people trusted them. Here one can name the last Princess Vyazemskaya, a most prominent post-revolutionary informer, as was her son on the Solovetsky Islands. And Concordia Nikolaevna Iose was evidently a woman of brilliant qualities. Her husband was an officer who had been shot in her presence, and she herself was exiled to the Solovetsky Islands. But she managed to beg her way out, and to set up a salon near the big Lubyanka, which the important figures of that establishment loved to frequent. She was not arrested again until 1937, along with her Yagoda customers. It is strange to recount, but as a result of an absurd tradition, the political Red Cross had been preserved from old Russia. There were three branches, the Moscow branch, Y. Peshkova Vinava, the Kharkov, Sandomiskaya, and the Petrograd. The one in Moscow behaved itself and was not dissolved until 1937. The one in Petrograd, the old Narodnik Sheptsov, the cripple Gartman and Kocharovsky, adopted an intolerably impudent stance, mixed into political cases, tried to get support from such former inmates of the Schlüsselburg prison as Nonovorusky, who had been convicted in the same case as Lenin's brother, Alexander Ulyanov, and helped not only socialists, but also KRs, counter-revolutionaries. In 1926, it was shut down, and its leaders were sent into exile. The years go by, and everything that has not been freshly recalled to us is wiped from our memory. In the dim distance, we see the year 1927 as a careless, well-fed year of the still untruncated NEP. But in fact, it was tense. It shuddered as newspaper headlines exploded, and it was considered at the time, and portrayed to us then, as the threshold of a war for world revolution. The assassination of the Soviet ambassador in Warsaw, which filled whole columns of the papers that June, aroused Mayakovsky to dedicate four thunderous verses to the subject. But here's bad luck for you. Poland offered an apology. Voykov's lone assassin was arrested there, and so how and against whom was the poet's appeal to be directed? Evidently the monarchist in question assassinated Voykov as an act of private vengeance. It is said that as Ural's provincial commissar of foodstuffs in July 1918, P.L. Voykov had directed the destruction of all traces of the shooting of the Tsar's family, the dissection and dismemberment of the corpses, the cremation of the remains, and the dispersal of the ashes. With cohesion, construction, grit, and repression, wring the neck of this gang run riot. Who was to be repressed? Whose neck should be wrung? It was then that the so-called Voykov draft began. As always happened when there were incidents of disturbance or tension, they arrested former people, anarchists, SRs, Mensheviks, and also the intelligentsia as such. Indeed, who else was there to arrest in the cities? Not the working class. But the old close-to-the-cadets intelligentsia had already been thoroughly shaken up, starting in 1919. Had the time not come to shake up that part of the intelligentsia which imagined itself to be progressive? To give the students a once-over. Once again, Mayakovsky came to the rescue. Think about the Komsomol for days and for weeks. Look over your ranks, watch them with care. Are all of them really Komsomols? Or are they only pretending to be? A convenient world outlook gives rise to a convenient juridical term, social prophylaxis. It was introduced and accepted, and it was immediately understood by all. Lazar Kogan, one of the bosses of the White Sea Canal construction, would in fact soon say, "I believe that you personally were not guilty of anything, but as an educated person you have to understand that social prophylaxis was being widely applied." And when else, in fact, should unreliable fellow travellers, all that shaky intellectual rot, be arrested, if not on the eve of the war for world revolution? When the big war actually began, it would be too late. And so in Moscow they began a systematic search, block by block. Someone had to be arrested everywhere. The slogan was, "We are going to bang our fist on the table so hard that the world will shake with terror." It was to the Lubyanka, to the Butyrki, that the black mariahs, the passenger cars, the enclosed trucks, the open hansom cabs kept moving, even by day. There was a jam at the gates, a jam in the courtyard. They didn't have time to unload and register those they'd arrested. And the same situation existed in other cities. In Rostov-on-the-Don, during those days, the floor was so crowded in the cellar of House 33 that the newly arrived Boyko could hardly find a place to sit down. A typical example from this wave. Several dozen young people got together for some kind of musical evening which had not been authorized ahead of time by the GPU. They listened to music and then drank tea. They got the money for the tea by voluntarily contributing their own kopecks. It was quite clear, of course, that this music was a cover for counter-revolutionary sentiments, and that the money was being collected not for tea, but to assist the dying world bourgeoisie. And they were all arrested and given from 3 to 10 years. Anna Skripnikova getting 5, while Ivan Nikolaevich Varentsov and the other organizers of the affair who refused to confess were shot. And in that same year, somewhere in Paris, a group of Russian émigré lycées graduates gathered to celebrate the traditional Pushkin holiday. A report of this was published in the papers. It was clearly an intrigue on the part of mortally wounded imperialism. And as a result, all lycée graduates still left in the USSR were arrested, as were the so-called law students, graduates of another such privileged special school of pre-revolutionary Russia. Only the size of SLON, the Solovetsky Special Purpose Camp, limited for the time being the scale of the Voykov draft. But the Gulag archipelago had already begun its malignant life, and would shortly metastasize throughout the whole body of the nation. A new taste had been acquired, and a new appetite began to grow. The time had long since arrived to crush the technical intelligentsia, which had come to regard itself as too irreplaceable and had not gotten used to catching instructions on the wing. In other words, we never did trust the engineers, and from the very first years of the revolution we saw to it that those lackeys and servants of former capitalist bosses were kept in line by healthy suspicion and surveillance by the workers. However, during the Reconstruction period, we did permit them to work in our industries, while the whole force of the class assault was directed against the rest of the intelligentsia. But the more our own economic leadership matured, in VSNKH, the Supreme Council of the Economy, and Gosplan, the State Planning Commission, the more the number of plans increased, and the more those plans overlapped and conflicted with one another, the clearer became the old engineers' basic commitment to wrecking, their insincerity, slyness, venality. The sentinel of the revolution narrowed its eyes with even greater vigilance, and wherever it directed its narrowed gaze, it immediately discovered a nest of wreckers. This therapy continued full speed from 1927 on, and immediately exposed to the proletariat all the causes of our economic failures and shortages. There was wrecking in the People's Commissariat of Railroads. That was why it was hard to get aboard a train, why there were interruptions in supplies. There was wrecking in the Moscow electric power system, and interruptions in power. There was wrecking in the oil industry, hence the shortage of kerosene. There was wrecking in textiles, hence nothing for a working man to wear. In the coal industry, there was colossal wrecking, hence no heat. In the metallurgy, defense, machinery, shipbuilding, chemical, mining, gold and platinum industries, in irrigation, everywhere there were these pus-filled boils of wrecking. Enemies with slide rules were on all sides. The GPU puffed and panted in its efforts to grab off and drag off the wreckers. In the capitals and in the provinces, GPU collegiums and proletarian courts kept hard at work, sifting through this viscous sewage, and every day the workers gasped to learn, and sometimes they didn't learn, from the papers of new vile deeds. They learned about Palchinsky, von Meck, and Velichko, and how many others who were nameless. A.F. Velichko, a military engineer, former professor of the Military Academy of the General Staff, and a lieutenant general, had been in charge of the administration for military transport in the Tsarist War Ministry. He was shot. Oh, how useful he would have been in 1941. Every industry, every factory, and every handicraft artel had to find wreckers in its ranks, and no sooner had they begun to look than they found them, with the help of the GPU. If any pre-revolutionary engineer was not yet exposed as a traitor, then he could certainly be suspected of being one. And what accomplished villains these old engineers were, what diabolical ways to sabotage they found. Nikolai Karlovich von Meck, of the People's Commissariat of Railroads, pretended to be terribly devoted to the development of the new economy, and would hold forth for hours on end about the economic problems involved in the construction of socialism, and he loved to give advice. One such pernicious piece of advice was to increase the size of freight trains and not worry about heavier-than-average loads. The GPU exposed von Meck, and he was shot. His objective had been to wear out rails and roadbeds, freight cars and locomotives, so as to leave the Republic without railroads in case of foreign military intervention. When, not long afterward, the new People's Commissar of Railroads, Comrade Kaganovich, ordered that average loads should be increased and even doubled and tripled them, and for this discovery received the order of Lenin, along with others of our leaders, the malicious engineers who protested became known as limiters. They raised the outcry that this was too much and would result in the breakdown of the rolling stock, and they were rightly shot for their lack of faith in the possibilities of socialist transport. These limiters were pursued for several years. In all branches of the economy, they brandished their formulas and calculations and refused to understand that bridges and lathes could respond to the enthusiasm of the personnel. These were the years when all the norms of folk psychology were turned inside out. The circumspect folk wisdom expressed in such a proverb as, haste makes waste, was ridiculed, and the ancient saying that the slower you go, the farther you'll get, was turned inside out. The only thing which at times delayed the arrest of the old engineers was the absence of a new batch to take their place. Nikolai Ivanovich Ladizhensky, chief engineer of defense plants in Izhevsk, was first arrested for limitation theories and blind faith in safety factors, which explained why he considered inadequate the funds allocated by Orjonikidze for factory expansion. They say that when Orjonikidze used to talk with the old engineers, he would put one pistol on his desk beside his right hand and another beside his left. Then they put him under house arrest and ordered him back to work in his old job. Without him, the work was collapsing. He put it back in shape. But the funds allocated were just as inadequate as they had been earlier, and so, once again, he was thrown in prison, this time for incorrect use of funds. The funds were insufficient, they charged, because the chief engineer had used them inefficiently. Ladizhensky died in camp after a year of timbering. Thus, in the course of a few years, they broke the back of the old Russian engineers who had constituted the glory of the country, who were the beloved heroes of such writers as Garin Mikhailovsky, Chekhov, and Zamyatin. It is to be understood, of course, that in this wave, as in all of them, other people were taken too, for example, those who had been near and dear to and connected with those doomed. I hesitate to sully the shining bronze countenance of the sentinel of the revolution, yet I must. They also arrested persons who refused to become informers. We would ask the reader to keep in mind at all times, but especially in connection with the first post-revolutionary decade, this entirely secret wave, which never surfaced in public. At that time, people still had their pride, and many of them quite failed to comprehend that morality is a relative thing, having only a narrow class meaning. And they dared to reject the employment offered them, and they were all punished without mercy. In fact, at this time, young Magdalena Edzhubova was supposed to act as an informer on a group of engineers, and she not only dared to refuse, but also told her guardian it was against him she was supposed to inform. However, he was arrested soon anyway, and in the course of the investigation he confessed everything. Edzhubova, who was pregnant, was arrested for revealing an operational secret, and was sentenced to be shot, but subsequently managed to get off with a 25-year string of sentences. In that same year, 1927, though in a completely different milieu, among the leading Kharkov communists, Nadezhda Vitalievna Sorovets refused to become an informer and spy on members of the Ukrainian government. For this, she was arrested by the GPU, and not until a quarter of a century later did she manage to emerge, barely alive, in the Kolyma. As for those who didn't survive, of them we know nothing. In the 30s, this wave of the disobedient fell off to zero. If they asked you to, then it meant you had to inform. Where would you hide? The weakest go to the wall. If I don't, someone else will. Better me than someone bad. Meanwhile, there were plenty of volunteers. You couldn't get away from them. It was both profitable and praiseworthy. In 1928 in Moscow, the big Shakhty case came to trial, big in terms of the publicity it was given, in the startling confessions and self-flagellation of the defendants, though not yet all of them. 2 years later, in September 1930, the famine organizers were tried with a great hue and cry. They were the ones. There they are. There were 48 wreckers in the food industry. At the end of 1930, the trial of the Prompati was put on with even greater fanfare. It had been faultlessly rehearsed. In this case, every single defendant took upon himself the blame for every kind of filthy rubbish. And then, like a monument unveiled, there arose before the eyes of the workers the grandiose, cunningly contrived skein in which all the separate wrecking cases previously exposed were tied into one diabolical knot, along with Milyukov, Ryabushinsky, Deterding, and Poincaré. As we begin to understand our judicial practices, we realize now that the public trials were only the surface indications of the mole's tunnel, and that all the main digging lay beneath the surface. At these trials, only a small number of those arrested were produced in court, only those who agreed to the unnatural practice of accusing themselves and others in the hope of getting off more easily. The majority of the engineers, who had the courage and intelligence to reject and refute the interrogator's stupidities, were tried out of earshot. But even though they did not confess, they got the same tenors from the collegium of the GPU. The waves flowed underground through the pipes. They provided sewage disposal for the life flowering on the surface. It was precisely at this moment that an important step was taken toward universal participation in sewage disposal, universal distribution of responsibility for it. Those who had not yet been swept bodily down the sewer hatches, who had not yet been carried through the pipes to the archipelago, had to march up above, carrying banners praising the trial and rejoicing at the judicial reprisals. And this was very far-sighted. Decades would pass, and history would have its eyes opened. But the interrogators, judges, and prosecutors would turn out to be no more guilty than you and I, fellow citizens. The reason we possess our worthy grey heads is that in our time we worthily voted for. Stalin carried out the first such effort in connection with the trial of the famine organizers, and how could it not succeed when everyone was starving in bounteous Russia, and everyone was always looking about and asking, where did all our dear bread get to? Therefore, before the court verdict, the workers and employees wrathfully voted for the death penalty for the scoundrels on trial. And by the time of the Prompati trial, there were universal meetings and demonstrations, including even schoolchildren. It was the newspaper march of millions, and the roar rose outside the windows of the courtroom, "Death! Death! Death!" At this turning point in our history, there were some lonely voices of protest or abstention, and very, very great bravery was required to say no in the midst of that roaring chorus of approval. It is incomparably easier today. Yet even today, people don't very often vote against. To the extent that we know about them, it was those same spineless, slushy intellectuals. At the meeting of the Leningrad Polytechnic Institute, Professor Dmitry Apollinarievich Rozhansky abstained. He was an enemy of capital punishment in general, you see. In the language of science, you see, this was an irreversible process. And he was arrested then and there. The student, Dima Ulitsky, abstained and was arrested then and there. Thus, all these protests were silenced at the very source. So far as we know, the grey-moustached working class approved these executions. So far as we know, from the blazing Komsomols right up to the party leaders and the legendary army commanders, the entire vanguard waxed unanimous in approving these executions. Famous revolutionaries, theoreticians and prophets, 7 years before their own inglorious destruction, welcomed the roar of the crowd, not guessing then that their own time stood on the threshold, that soon their own names would be dragged down in that roar of scum, filth. In fact, for the engineers, the rout soon came to an end. At the beginning of 1931, Yosif Vissarionovich spake his 6 conditions for construction, and his autocracy vouchsafed as the 5th condition. We must move from a policy of destruction of the old technical intelligentsia to a policy of concern for it, of making use of it. Concern for it? What has happened in the meantime to our just wrath? Where had all our terrible accusations gone to? At this very moment, as it happened, a trial of wreckers in the porcelain industry was underway. They had been playing their filthy tricks even there. All the defendants had damned each other in unison and confessed to everything. And suddenly they cried out in unison again, "We are innocent." And they were freed. There was even a small reverse wave to be remarked in this particular year. Some engineers who had already been sentenced or put under interrogation were released. Thus, D.A. Rozhansky came back. Should we not say he had won his duel with Stalin? And that if people had been heroic in exercising their civil responsibilities, there would never have been any reason to write either this chapter or this whole book. That same year, Stalin was still engaged in grinding beneath his hoof the long-since prostrate Mensheviks. There was a public trial in March 1931 of the All-Union Bureau of Mensheviks, Groman, Sukhanov, and Yakubovich, and a certain number of small, scattered, unannounced arrests took place in addition. The Sukhanov referred to here was the same Sukhanov in whose apartment on the Karpovka in Petrograd, and with whose knowledge, and the guides there nowadays are lying when they say it was without his knowledge, the Bolshevik Central Committee met on October 10, 1917, and adopted its decision to launch an armed uprising. And suddenly, Stalin reconsidered. The White Sea folk say of the tide, the water reconsiders, meaning the moment just before it begins to fall. Well, of course, it is inappropriate to compare the murky soul of Stalin with the water of the White Sea. And perhaps he didn't reconsider anything whatever. Nor was there any ebb tide. But one more miracle happened that year. In 1931, following the trial of the Promparty, a grandiose trial of the Working Peasants' Party was being prepared, on the grounds that they existed, never an actual fact, as an enormous organized underground force among the rural intelligentsia, including leaders of consumer and agricultural cooperatives, and the more advanced upper layer of the peasantry, and supposedly were preparing to overthrow the dictatorship of the proletariat. At the trial of the Promparty, this Working Peasants' Party, the TKP, was referred to as if it were already well known and under detention. The interrogation apparatus of the GPU was working flawlessly. Thousands of defendants had already fully confessed their adherence to the TKP and participation in its criminal plans, and no less than 200,000 members altogether were promised by the GPU. Mentioned as heading the party were the agricultural economist Alexander Vasilievich Chayanov, the future Prime Minister N.D. Kondratyev, Elen Yurovsky, Makarov, and Alexei Doyarenko, a professor from the Timiryazev Academy, future Minister of Agriculture. He might well have been a better one than those who held the job for the next 40 years. But how strange is human fate. As a matter of principle, Doyarenko was always non-political. When his daughter used to bring home fellow students who expressed opinions savouring of socialist revolutionary views, he made them leave. Then, all of a sudden, one lovely night, Stalin reconsidered. Why? Maybe we will never know. Did he perhaps wish to save his soul? Too soon for that, it would seem. Did his sense of humour come to the fore? Was it all so deadly, monotonous, so bitter-tasting? But no one would ever dare accuse Stalin of having a sense of humour. Likeliest of all, Stalin simply figured out that the whole countryside, not just 200,000 people, would soon die of famine anyway, so why go to the trouble? And instantly the whole TKP trial was called off. All those who had confessed were told they could repudiate their confessions. One can picture their happiness. And instead of the whole big catch, only the small group of Kondratyev and Chayanov was hauled in and tried. Kondratyev, sentenced to solitary confinement, became mentally ill there and died. Yurovsky also died. Chayanov was exiled to Alma-Ata after 5 years in solitary and was arrested again there in 1948. In 1941, the charge against the tortured Vavilov was that the TKP had existed and he had been its head. Paragraph piles on paragraph, year on year, and yet there is no way we can describe in sequence everything that took place, but the GPU did its job effectively. The GPU never let anything get by. But we must always remember that religious believers, of course, were being arrested uninterruptedly. There were, nonetheless, certain special dates and peak periods. There was a night of struggle against religion in Leningrad on Christmas Eve 1929, when they arrested a large part of the religious intelligentsia and held them not just until morning either. And that was certainly no Christmas tale. Then in February 1932, again in Leningrad, many churches were closed simultaneously, while at the same time large-scale arrests were made among the clergy. And there are still more dates and places, but they haven't been reported to us by anyone. Non-Orthodox sects were also under constant attack, even those sympathetic to communism. Thus, in 1929, they arrested every last member of the communes between Sochi and Costa. These communes ran everything, both production and distribution, on a communist basis, and it was all done fairly and honestly in a way the rest of the country won't achieve in 100 years. But, alas, they were too literate. They were well read in religious literature, and atheism was not their philosophy, which combined Baptist and Tolstoyan beliefs with those of yoga. It appeared that such a commune was criminal and that it could not bring people happiness. In the 20s, a large group of Tolstoyans was exiled to the foothills of the Altai, and there they established communal settlements jointly with the Baptists. When the construction of the Kuznetsk industrial complex began, they supplied it with food products. Then arrests began. First the teachers, they were not teaching in accordance with the government programs, and the children ran after the cars, shouting. And after that, the commune leaders were taken. The big solitaire game played with the socialists went on and on, uninterruptedly, of course. In 1929 also, those historians who had not been sent abroad in time were arrested. Platonov, Tarla, Lyubavsky, Gotyi, Lekachev, Izhmailov, and the outstanding literary scholar M.M. Bakhtin. From one end of the country to the other, nationalities kept pouring in. The Yakuts were imprisoned after the revolt of 1928. The Buryat Mongols were imprisoned after the uprising of 1929, and they say about 35,000 were shot, a figure it has been impossible to verify. The Kazakhs were imprisoned after Budeni's cavalry heroically crushed their revolt in 1930 and 1931. The Union for Liberation of the Ukraine was put on trial at the beginning of 1930. Professor Yefremov, Tchaikovsky, Nikovsky, etc. And knowing the ratio in our country of what is public to what is secret, how many others followed in their footsteps? How many were secretly arrested? Then came the time, slowly it is true but surely, when it was the turn of the members of the ruling party to do time in prison. At first, from 1927 to 1929, it was a question of the workers' opposition, in other words, the Trotskyites, who had chosen themselves such an unsuccessful leader. They numbered hundreds at the start. Soon there would be thousands. But it's the first step that's the hardest. Just as these Trotskyites had observed with approval the arrest of members of other parties, so the rest of the party now watched approvingly as the Trotskyites were arrested. But everyone would have his turn. The non-existent rightist opposition would come later, and limb by limb, beginning with its own tail, the ravenous maw would devour itself, right up to its head. From 1928 on, it was time to call to a reckoning those late stragglers after the bourgeoisie, the NEP men. The usual practice was to impose on them ever-increasing and finally totally intolerable taxes. At a certain point, they could no longer pay. They were immediately arrested for bankruptcy, and their property was confiscated. Small tradesmen, such as barbers, tailors, even those who repaired Primus stoves, were only deprived of their licenses to ply their trade. There was an economic purpose to the development of the NEP men wave. The state needed property and gold, and there was as yet no Kolyma. The famous gold fever began at the end of 1929. Only the fever gripped not those looking for gold, but those from whom it was being shaken loose. The particular feature of this new gold wave was that the GPU was not actually accusing these rabbits of anything, and was perfectly willing not to send them off to Gulag country, but wished only to take away their gold by main force. So the prisons were packed, the interrogators were worn to a frazzle, but the transit prisons, prisoner transports and camps received only relatively minor reinforcements. Who was arrested in the gold wave? All those who, at one time or another, 15 years before, had had a private business, had been involved in retail trade, had earned wages at a craft, and could have, according to the GPU's deductions, hoarded gold. But it so happened that they often had no gold. They had put their money into real estate or securities, which had melted away or been taken away in the revolution, and nothing remained. They had high hopes, of course, in arresting dental technicians, jewelers, and watch repairmen. Through denunciations, one could learn about gold in the most unexpected places. A veteran lathe worker had somewhere gotten hold of and held on to 60 gold, 5-ruble pieces from Tsarist times. The famous Siberian partisan, Muraviev, had come to Odessa, bringing with him a small bag full of gold. The Petersburg Tatar draymen all had gold hidden away. Whether or not these things were so could be discovered only inside prison walls. Nothing, neither proletarian origin nor revolutionary services, served as a defense against a gold denunciation. All were arrested, all were crammed into GPU cells in numbers no one had considered possible up to then, but that was all to the good. They would cough it up all the sooner. It even reached a point of such confusion that men and women were imprisoned in the same cells and used the latrine bucket in each other's presence. Who cared about those niceties? Give up your gold, vipers! The interrogators did not write up charge sheets because no one needed their papers, and whether or not a sentence would be pasted on was of very little interest. Only one thing was important. Give up your gold, viper. The state needs gold, and you don't. The interrogators had neither voice nor strength left to threaten and torture. They had one universal method. Feed the prisoners nothing but salty food and give them no water. Whoever coughed up gold got water. One gold piece for a cup of fresh water. People perish for cold metal. This wave was distinguished from those that preceded and followed it because, even though fewer than half its victims held their fate in their own hands, some did. If you in fact had no gold, then your situation was hopeless. You would be beaten, burned, tortured, and steamed to the point of death, or until they finally came to believe you. But if you had gold, you could determine the extent of your torture, the limits of your endurance, and your own fate. Psychologically, this situation was, incidentally, not easier but more difficult. Because if you made an error, you would always be ridden by a guilty conscience. Of course, anyone who had already mastered the rules of the institution would yield and give up his gold. That was easier. But it was a mistake to give it up too readily. They would refuse to believe you had coughed it all up, and they would continue to hold you. But you'd be wrong, too, to wait too long before yielding. You'd end up kicking the bucket, or they'd paste a term on you out of meanness. One of the Tatar draymen endured all the tortures. He had no gold. They imprisoned his wife, too, and tortured her, but the Tatar stuck to his story. No gold. Then they arrested his daughter. The Tatar couldn't take it any more. He coughed up 100,000 rubles. At this point, they let his family go, but slapped a prison term on him. The crudest detective stories and operas about brigands were played out in real life on a vast national scale. The introduction of the passport system on the threshold of the 30s also provided the camps with a good-sized draft of reinforcements. Just as Peter I simplified the social structure, sweeping clean all the nooks and crannies of the old Russian class system, so our socialist passport system swept out, in particular, the betwixt and between insects. It hit at the clever, homeless portion of the population, which wasn't tied down to anything. In the early stages, people made many mistakes with those passports, and those not registered at their places of residence, and those not registered as having left their former places of residence, were raked into the archipelago, if only for a single year. And so the waves foamed and rolled, but over them all, in 1929 to 1930, billowed and gushed the multi-million wave of dispossessed kulaks. It was immeasurably large, and it would certainly not have been housed in even the highly developed network of Soviet interrogation prisons, which in any case were packed full by the gold wave. Instead, it bypassed the prisons, going directly to the transit prisons and camps, onto prisoner transports into the Gulag country. In sheer size, this non-recurring tidal wave, it was an ocean, swelled beyond the bounds of anything the penal system of even an immense state can permit itself. There was nothing to be compared with it in all Russian history. It was the forced resettlement of a whole people, an ethnic catastrophe. But yet so cleverly were the channels of the GPU Gulag organized that the cities would have noticed nothing had they not been stricken by a strange 3-year famine, a famine that came about without drought and without war. This wave was also distinct from all those which preceded it, because no one fussed about with taking the head of the family first and then working out what to do with the rest of the family. On the contrary, in this way they burned out whole nests, whole families, from the start. And they watched jealously to be sure that none of the children, 14, 10, even 6 years old, got away. To the last scrapings, all had to go down the same road, to the same common destruction. This was the first such experiment, at least in modern history. It was subsequently repeated by Hitler with the Jews, and again by Stalin with nationalities which were disloyal to him or suspected by him. This wave included only pathetically few of those kulaks for whom it was named, in order to draw the wool over people's eyes. In Russian, a kulak is a miserly, dishonest rural trader who grows rich not by his own labor, but through someone else's, through usury and operating as a middleman. In every locality, even before the revolution, such kulaks could be numbered on one's fingers, and the revolution totally destroyed their basis of activity.